Great, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for dialing in. I'm Dr. Kevin Fenton, Director of CDC's National Center for HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. I want to thank all of you for joining us today to talk about the state of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, nearly 25 years after CDC published a report of the first cases of a nameless deadly disease that had affected a handful of gay men in New York and Los Angeles. I haven't had the opportunity to work with many of you as yet, so please indulge me while I tell you a little bit about myself. I was raised and educated in Jamaica, where I went on to become a medical officer with a local health department. And in that position, I experienced firsthand the devastation of HIV and AIDS in a resource-strapped country. I know the reality of the scarcity that many HIV and AIDS programs overseas face on a daily basis, especially in developing nations. But I've also had the experience of directing HIV and STD prevention efforts for a wealthier government when I accepted a position and worked with the British government's National Health Service. Although HIV prevention programs are typically better funded in industrialized nations, as long as individuals in these countries, including the United States, continue to become infected, we must do more. But at home and abroad, we must continually step back and evaluate what is working and what is not. We must advocate for prevention resources to keep pace with the epidemic. We must be bold in our actions and fight complacency at every turn. For scarcity abroad and complacency at home are both enemies of progress as we mark this milestone of 25 years battling the epidemic. I'm honored to be joined today by one of CDC's and our nation's heroes in the AIDS fight, Dr. Jim Curran, Dean of the Rollins School of Public Health of Emory University here in Atlanta. As I'm sure most of you know, Dr. Curran led CDC's HIV prevention programs for over a decade. He was CDC's chief scientist in the efforts to investigate the first known case of AIDS cases in the early 1980s, and he's one of the most articulate and passionate public health leaders we have today. In fact, when the final chapters are written about how we, as a global community, finally put an end to this epidemic, I'm sure that Dr. Curran will be seen as a central force, from the earliest efforts to define HIV and AIDS to the tremendous successes we've had in the United States in preventing mother-to-child transmission, to the critical work of Emory's Center for AIDS Research, which they're doing in the search for a vaccine. Dr. Curran has been and continues to be front and center. I'm pleased to have him with us today to talk about his experiences and his unique perspectives about the epidemic. Now, I know most of you will be writing stories marking 25 years of AIDS shortly. Our purpose today is to briefly comment on the state of the epidemic then and now, and to give you a chance to ask questions to inform your reporting about this anniversary. I know that a number of other agencies, UNAIDS for one, will be providing background, context, and statistics about the global epidemic. For that reason, we are focusing today's discussion on the domestic epidemic. Since CDC has the largest megaphone available to many organizations and agencies that work to prevent HIV/AIDS in the United States, we feel a responsibility to focus your attention in that direction today. As you all know, that nameless syndrome discovered 25 years ago has become one of the deadliest epidemics in human history, killing more than 25 million people around the world, including more than 500,000 Americans. In the last decade, major advances in treatment for HIV/AIDS have prolonged and improved the lives of many. But as they will be the first to say, living with HIV infection is not easy. The drugs often cause serious side effects and sometimes don't work, especially over the long term. In 2004, 16,000 Americans died of AIDS. The inescapable truth, therefore, is that to defeat AIDS, both here and abroad, we need to reduce the number of people who become infected in the first place. 25 years into the epidemic, prevention is still the only cure we have for HIV/AIDS. Now, I'll always be impressed and inspired by the work begun by Dr. Curran and colleagues and carried out by the committed public health professionals at CDC and by thousands of individuals, communities, and organizations across the country over the last 2.5 decades. CDC staff played an important role in identifying the routes of transmission, quickly informing and educating the public about transmission and protection, providing guidance on HIV counseling and testing, protecting healthcare workers, creating an impressive partnership with national organizations, health departments, and community organizations that implement evidence-based prevention programs. The list could go on and on. These efforts have yielded some very important results. First, the number of annual infections has declined sharply from an estimated 150,000 new diagnoses at the height of the epidemic in the 1980s to about 40,000 infections in recent years. Annual HIV infection rates among injecting drug users declined during the 1990s from 10 to 14% to less than 2%. Perhaps the greatest success story to date is the dramatic declines in mother-to-child transmission of HIV in the United States. Today, only about 300 children are born each year infected with HIV, down from a high of 2,000 per year in the early and mid-1990s. The HIV burden also appears to be decreasing in some of the hardest hit groups, including African Americans, according to our most recent data on HIV diagnoses in the United States. Finally, our surveillance methods have improved, helping us to better target prevention efforts. 43 states now have confidential name-based reporting of HIV diagnoses, and CDC has put into place a new nationwide system to more accurately estimate new HIV infections. The first results of this system will be reported later this year. Now, you all have CDC's fact sheets on the burden of HIV and AIDS in the United States, so I won't discuss the data in any detail, though I will highlight a few points. First, more than 1 million Americans are currently living with HIV/AIDS, and nearly a quarter of these are still unaware of their HIV status. HIV/AIDS has hit African-American men and women the hardest. They account for half of all new HIV diagnoses in this country and more than a third of AIDS deaths to date. African-American men who have sex with men, or MSM, are especially hard hit. Recent data showed significant declines in HIV diagnoses in nearly every group of African Americans except black MSM. Indeed, one recent study in five cities found that almost half of black MSM were infected with HIV. Now, overall, MSM represent nearly half of all HIV diagnoses. They were hardest hit early on and remain a particularly vulnerable group today. Women represent a growing proportion of those affected by HIV, accounting for 29% of all HIV diagnoses in 2004. So what about our future challenges and priorities? Well, for me and for everyone at CDC working to stop HIV/AIDS, the fight is more than professional. It's also personal. So looking ahead, all of us at CDC are committed to a strong prevention response. Experience has shown us that there is no single magic bullet, but there are several key strategies that CDC is pursuing in partnership with communities across the country that can and will help us to reduce the suffering from this entirely preventable disease. First, we must greatly increase access to voluntary HIV testing. CDC estimates that most new HIV infections in the United States are transmitted by the 25% of people with HIV who do not even realize that they are infected. We need to expand access to HIV testing dramatically by making it a routine part of medical care and by ensuring easy access to new rapid HIV tests. Second, we must focus prevention on both HIV-positive and HIV-negative people. More than 1 million Americans are living with HIV and AIDS, and while it's critical to help people at risk avoid contracting the virus in the first place, equally important is helping those who are HIV-positive to avoid transmitting it to others. Third, it is critical that we reduce racial and ethnic disparities by working with local communities to develop and implement culturally appropriate and effective methods at the local level. Fourth, we must continue to address the role of substance misuse and abuse. From intravenous drugs to alcohol to methamphetamine, substance abuse is a key reason that people who know how to protect themselves and others from HIV still take serious risks. Preventing substance abuse and increasing access to treatment is critical in helping people make the right decisions. In 2006, we're committing $650 million to pursue these and other effective HIV prevention strategies that reach the people most at risk and that speak their language. HIV infection remains a serious and potentially fatal condition. We have learned over the past 25 years that HIV prevention is not easy. It requires a lifelong commitment from everyone, from those infected, from those at risk, and from society as a whole. Finally, I'd like to summarize two important and related CDC events that will be of interest to you. The first is the 2006 National STD Prevention Conference, which will be held in Jacksonville, Florida next Monday through Thursday, May 8th to 11th. We will be holding telephone press briefings at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday and Tuesday, and at 12 noon on Wednesday to release new data on syphilis, chlamydia, and trends in oral and anal intercourse among young people and little-known but potentially serious STDs such as bacterial vaginosis, trichomoniasis, and lymphogranuloma venereum. You can get further details on these events from CDC's press office. The second key event is to let you know that our MMWR publication will be releasing a special issue commemorating the 25th anniversary of HIV/AIDS on June 2nd. That issue will publish reports on HIV epidemiologic trends between 1981 and 2004, HIV prevention accomplishments over the past 25 years, and current challenges, and the successes and challenges in preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV. I'll conclude my remarks by saying that on this 25th commemoration, the best way we can honor the 500,000 Americans, as well as the many millions across the globe who have died of AIDS, is to stop the spread of this deadly disease. Now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Jim Curran.
Kevin, thank you very much, and welcome to everybody. I see from the press list that I have many old friends and colleagues and many veterans of AIDS reporting, some even going back all the way to 25 years. So I'd like, first of all, to thank all of you in the press, to welcome those relative newcomers to reporting on AIDS, and to thank especially the veterans who've been reporting for many years on this problem. Your extensive reporting and information during the 1980s and early 1990s really brought the AIDS epidemic to the forefront and really helped reduce those transmission numbers a great deal due to the public information campaign. For those of you old-timers, we are the last generation to really know what a life in a world without AIDS is like, and we are the transition generation to the newcomers, to those who live in a world with AIDS. It's sometimes difficult to reflect on 25 years about going back to five cases of pneumocystis in gay men in June of 1981 to understand how something which began so slowly and so quietly and so silently could now be the number four cause of death in the entire world, something that is continuing to grow with 2 million more people becoming infected than are dying each year, and something which seems to know no bounds in its insidious stretch around the world as a cause of death, and causing 40 million human incubators carrying other infectious diseases, something that we thought was a small problem back then. And I'm always back thinking that even in the early 1980s, we were always greatly concerned that we would underestimate the burden and impact of AIDS on the population in the United States and throughout the world. And I think we still have to consider that we may be underestimating the burden and impact of this insidious global epidemic, and that perhaps silence does still equal death on the worldwide scene, and that denial and complacency are still the greatest enemies to progress. 25 years seems like a long time in one sense, but I can say that the time has gone by in a heartbeat, and I'm amazed by the scientific progress and the progress of many of the people who work to prevent the disease, but I'm even more amazed by the insidious, inexorable progress of the virus around the world. From 1981 to the present, the CDC has played a very important role and continues to play a very crucial role in HIV prevention throughout the world. Initially, it was the discovery of the epidemic and the excellent case definition and surveillance, which defined the epidemiologic patterns and led to prevention recommendations well before the virus was even discovered, so that the blood supply could be protected, that health and laboratory workers and people like gay men could be protected from further spread of the disease before it could be protected. That surveillance was perhaps the most important thing early in the epidemic, and good surveillance continues to be very important in the United States and throughout the world in designing and targeting prevention efforts to those at greatest risk and evaluating the extent to which those efforts are effective. In terms of lessons learned in the last 25 years, the first lesson I've already mentioned, and that is the importance of outstanding surveillance systems, both in the United States and abroad, measuring both HIV infection rates as well as behaviors at greatest risk in those populations at greatest risk. Second of all, I'm impressed that innovative science has overcome skeptics, both in the early discovery of the virus itself, the fact that antiretrovirals would have any effect whatsoever on the disease. People were very skeptical that the 076 trial, giving antiretrovirals to pregnant women, would be effective, and yet it's led to this dramatic decline in the number of babies born in the United States with HIV. And finally, HART itself, which has revolutionized treatment for HIV, was something that people were very skeptical would ever work. So with that in mind, I think we shouldn't be skeptical about curative therapy. We shouldn't be skeptical about an effective vaccine. And we shouldn't continue to be skeptical about prevention efforts. The third lesson is that HIV prevention works. It works if its hands are not tied by local, national, or international political considerations, and if the things that we know and think work, that are peer-based, population-based efforts, can be undertaken, and they can be resourced at the appropriate levels. Prevention is difficult, though, because of stigma and denial, and because of the poverty that many people that are most affected by HIV are mired in. Stigma remains, I think, the greatest barrier to prevention. And it's a reason that many people refuse to be tested or are not tested for HIV, that as well as their as well as poverty. So I think that the thing that I would hope is that that you guys in the press take a new look at HIV and become activists again. Push all of us hard. Become investigative reporters. And act like the AIDS epidemic is in danger of threatening the world as I see it. Thank you very much for what you're doing, and thank you for your continued interest.
Thank you very much, Dr. Curran. Now, before we take questions, I'd like to introduce you to some CDC colleagues who are here with me today in order to make sure that we provide you with the kinds of information you need for your stories. We have Dr. Tim Mastro, who is the Acting Director of the Division of HIV and AIDS Prevention, Dr. Rich Wilitsky, Chief of our Prevention Research Branch, Dr. Matt McKenna, Chief of our HIV Incidence and Case Surveillance Branch, and Dr. Greg Millett, also in our Prevention Research Branch. Now let's proceed with your questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, before we go to questions, this conference will be available for replay after 4:30 Eastern Time today through June 12th. You may access the AT&T teleconference replay system at any time by dialing 1-800-475-6701 and entering the access code 828-348. International participants dial 320-365-3844 with the access code 828-348. And if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone phone. You will hear a tone indicating you have been placed in queue. You may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star one at this time. One moment, please, for the first question. Your first question comes from the line of Christine Gorman from Time Magazine. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. My question is, there have been a couple of reports recently talking about the possibility that AIDS is peaking, the epidemic is peaking. Can you help us understand what that means in terms of where the epidemic might be going, what efforts are working? Is that just the natural history of the epidemic? Do we still need to push, and why?
I'm going to ask Dr. Mastro to respond to that.
Thank you. I think you may be referring to a publication in Lancet about 2 weeks ago, which had a report from southern India about rates there declining, and an accompanying editorial that talked about perhaps globally the number of new infections per year had reached its peak within the last couple of years. I think today we're going to talk mainly about the U.S. domestic situation, and we're very concerned that there's a continued large number of new infections per year in the United States, estimated around 40,000. Probably the number of new infections in the U.S. peaked quite some number of years ago, perhaps back in the 1980s, and it was really the result of the prevention efforts in the United States that resulted in a dramatic decline in the very high incidence rates we experienced in the 80s. And we now, however, have reached a situation where we have a frustratingly difficult ongoing epidemic of ongoing transmission in the U.S.
So even though in the U.S. Cases peaked, I guess to the untutored person, they'd say, well, if the epidemic peaked back in the 80s, why do we still have to do anything? Or, I mean, won't it just burn itself out? And how do you respond to that?
Well, from an epidemiologic point of view, we have an ongoing, long-term epidemic. This is not like a point source where there's a burst of infections and then it peters out over time. So we're in this for the long haul. We're now 25 years into it, and despite our efforts on HIV prevention to date, while we've made great success in some areas, the epidemic continues to change, and there are, we think, an ongoing 40,000 infections in the United States. So we have to continue, and we'd actually like to do much better than this and actually bring the number of new infections down considerably.
And your next question comes from the line of Mike Stobie from Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. Dr. Fenn, I think it was you who mentioned that we need to keep moving forward, and one of the things we need to do is increase voluntary testing in different settings. What is the CDC and the government doing on that front, or what are the next steps to increase testing in the general population?
Well, as you say, increasing testing is definitely a key initiative for the U.S. government and for CDC. It's vitally important that individuals are aware of their HIV status, and if they're HIV positive, able to be linked to effective treatment and prevention care services. CDC has a number of initiatives currently in progress to promote HIV testing among the U.S. population. Perhaps one of the most exciting developments upcoming is the revision of our HIV testing guidelines for adult, adolescents, and pregnant women in clinical care settings, where we're really moving to modernizing HIV testing in these settings to make HIV testing far more routine than is currently done in clinical settings. What we're also looking at doing is simplifying the process for HIV testing by removing the onerous requirements for pre-test counseling in clinical settings so that we effectively remove some of the barriers to HIV testing in these sites.
What's the proposal to remove pre-test counseling? Is that legislation, or is that some guidance you're sending to? How would that work?
It's guidance, and what we're proposing to do is to simplify and remove, in some circumstances, the requirements for extensive pre-test counseling in clinical care settings, bearing in mind that for HIV testing, which is occurring outside of clinical care settings, there will still be a requirement for pre-test counseling to be done for individuals in those settings. What we're essentially trying to do is to effectively address the barriers for HIV testing in clinical care sites. In our discussions with many of our clinical colleagues, we know that a significant barrier is the current time it takes for HIV pretest counseling. And this is a barrier for colleagues in clinical settings to actually raise HIV testing and to deliver HIV tests.
And your next question comes from the line of Jeremy Manier from Chicago Tribune. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think that Dr. Curran and some others alluded to the mother-child transmission issue having come down so dramatically. I wonder if you could just comment a little more on that, as far as, you know, the importance of having come down to what is now the low number, what's the significance of that number today, you know, what are those kids who were born with it and, you know, are still around have to deal with now, having dealt with HIV all their lives up to 20-plus years in some cases, and if you have time, what this means for the global picture.
Okay, I'm going to ask Dr. Mastro to respond to that.
Yeah, thank you for that question. As Dr. Fenton pointed out, we think the prevention of mother-to-child transmission has really been one of the great success stories in the last 25 years, and Dr. Curran alluded to this, that when the original study was done, it was known as the 076 study, to give antiretroviral agents, AZT, to pregnant women in the hopes of preventing transmission. There was initially skepticism that would work. Indeed, it was a great success, and that trial showed a two-thirds reduction in the probability of a HIV-infected woman passing the virus to her infant. Since then, we've improved on that, and we now, with multi-drug therapy, have reduced the probability of an infected woman transmitting the virus to her infant down to less than 2%. So in the United States, the foundation on this program really is comprehensive HIV testing of pregnant women. And CDC issued recommendations in the mid-90s recommending that all pregnant women be tested for HIV. And this has allowed women to learn their status early in their pregnancy, take advantage of prevention modalities such as antiretrovirals, and the infant is also given antiretrovirals at the time of birth. And this has resulted in this dramatic decrease in transmission. This, of course, does result in some cases of perinatal transmission, and we're now to the situation of children that were born with HIV are now reaching adulthood. And we've had great improvements in treatment, and most of these children are now in antiretroviral treatment themselves for their own care.
Dr. Curran, would you like to respond as well?
Well, I think this is, in the United States, this has been a tremendous achievement. And it's been an achievement that's been made possible by the overall wealth of the United States and the capacity for many of these children's mothers to be treated with highly active antiretroviral therapy so that they continue to have a family unit. So you have a combination of HIV prevention to the newborn and HIV care to the mother fit into a society where things can work. Unfortunately, throughout the world, HIV transmission occurs in a context of abject poverty in many nations, where pregnant women will, even if they're treated with antiretrovirals, may give birth to a baby who then must be breastfed and go through a further risk of transmission, and the mother herself may end up dying, leaving the baby as an orphan. So it's even more necessary to overcome tremendous burdens of poverty in developing countries in order to put into context preventing transmission from the mother to the newborn. It points out that this is really a family disease in many cases, and that all members of the family must be provided for in order to assure a healthy society.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Victoria Elliott from American Medical News. Please go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask a little bit more about these testing guidelines that will be coming out. I was wondering if you knew when the new guidelines would be coming out, and I've heard rumors that they might endorse universal testing, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
We're anticipating that the guidelines will be released in the summer, and that will be June, July of this year. Regarding the second part of your question, could you repeat that for me, please?
Sure. I've heard rumors that it might recommend universal routine HIV testing, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I'll ask Dr. Mastro to respond to that.
Okay.
Thank you. One of our current strategies is really to increase the number of people that know their HIV infection status, and these new guidelines address clinical medical settings, and they recommend routinizing the nature of HIV testing so that it's not based on an assessment of the risk of the individual or the prevalence of the community in which the person resides. so that there would be a routine screening for HIV of all persons between the ages of 13 and 64, and that would be, again, separated from risk assessment or prevalence. People that have identified or ongoing risk behaviors should be tested more frequently, but we think that at least everyone ought to be tested at least once if they're in the 13 to 64 age group.
Your next question comes from the line of Delthea Ricks from Newsday. Please go ahead.
Yes, I would like for Dr. Curran, if he could, to recount for us when scientists first realized they were dealing with a virus in the early 80s. Did they realize early on that it was a virus or perhaps another type of pathogen?
When the first cases of pneumocystis pneumonia were reported to CDC, they were reported in gay men. Shortly thereafter, in the next few months, cases were reported in the injecting drug users. Many of us on the task force at CDC had worked closely with the gay community in the studies of hepatitis B transmission and on vaccine trials to prevent hepatitis B. So our leading hypothesis, really from day one, was that an underlying virus could be the cause, could well be the cause of the epidemic. Now, having said that, that could have been an alteration of a current virus or an abnormal response to a current virus, or it could be a new virus. I must say that this was not uniformly seen as the likely hypothesis, and there were lots of other hypotheses out there, and it wasn't until cases were diagnosed in persons with hemophilia, who were a very small population of the United States, known to be infected with bloodborne viruses through the receipt of their concentrates, that there was uniform acceptance of the viral hypothesis. That would have been in the summer of 1982.
Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Paul Shin from New York Daily News. Please go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Curran, if I could ask you to sort of walk down memory lane back in June of 1981, do you recall seeing that first patient with Kaposi sarcoma, and do you have vivid recollections of that?
It's a sign of aging that people ask you questions about walking down memory lane. But I'll tell you that after the first five cases of pneumocystis were reported, we began to both receive and make additional calls to colleagues in California, New York, and elsewhere. And we learned about a young gay man, a patient with Kaposi sarcoma, being seen at New York University Medical Center. And the person who received the call was a veterinarian. So since I was a physician, they asked me to go meet this man in New York the week after the first MMWR article. And I recall walking into NYU Medical Center and meeting a man who was almost precisely my age, who had come from a suburb of Detroit as I had, and had attended a Catholic high school as I had. He then went on to Yale, and I went on to pursue my studies elsewhere. And we were now back together, if you will, 20 years later, him with what I thought initially was a rare skin cancer that, frankly, I had never heard of until the week before, and me now investigating this case. The differences between us is that he was a gay man who had gone to New York to pursue an acting career, and that I had gone into medicine and medical epidemiology. And as I got to know him and watch his health decline and see him eventually die over the next several months, I realized that it was a virus that really separated us, and a virus that none of us could have known about. And I've thought about that many, many times since then.
And I have a quick follow-up question for Dr. Fenton relating to the perinatal infections. Do you know if New York City actually has the cumulative number, the largest cumulative number of perinatal infections?
I'll refer that question to my colleague, Dr. McKenna, to see if he has any if you can respond to that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. New York City definitely has the largest burden of any of the areas that report from around the country that we're aware of, but I'm not sure with that total number we don't have available right now.
If you'd like to follow that up with our press office, we'll be very happy to help you with the numbers on that.
And your next question comes from the line of Duncan Osborne from Gay City News. Please go ahead.
This is a question for Dr. Curran. Dr. Curran, you talked about, you said HIV prevention works if its hands are not tied by local, national, or international political concerns. Do you think that the hands of HIV prevention are tied in any way in the United States? And if they are, how are they tied?
Well, I think that I would say that the problems that we have with HIV is that when there's nobody paying attention to it, then of course there are no resources. When there are resources, people pay attention to it at all levels, whether it's the U.S. Congress or whether it's the mayor's office or the county commissioners or the state legislature. And so the politics of HIV are often national or even sometimes international, but the prevention has to occur at the level of the community. And if you have community people, whether they're gay men or they're poor urban or rural African Americans or they're migrant populations, and they're talking about sexuality, they don't simply trust governments at any level. They trust their peers, and they trust their peers to give them the best messages about what works and what doesn't. And a lot of times, at the political level, things get distorted by other agendas. So I think the biggest, the easiest example to talk about in the United States is how long it took us to deal effectively in any way with the epidemic in injecting drug users. Because as we know, virtually no one has respect for injecting drug users. They're virtually disliked by all, including their own ethnic populations in their own cities. So they have no political constituencies to speak of. And when it's found that needle and syringe exchange programs are effective, or when it's found that more effective and larger drug treatment programs are needed, it's very difficult to provide these kind of services to people that can deal with an addiction problem. And we were very slow in the United States in delivering effective services. And when it was done largely because of local initiatives.
Your next question comes from the line of Ryan Lee from Southern Voice. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I have a two-part question for Dr. Curran and anyone else who would like to comment. Excuse me. And it kind of piggybacks on the previous question. You talked about the slow response for IV drug users, but there was also a slow response in identifying it or combating it with gay men. I was wondering, are there any parallels between the ignorance that exists in the early 80s among the media and general public about AIDS and today's public and media message that seems to suggest HIV and AIDS is only a problem in Africa? And the second part of that problem is, or question is what role does sexual orientation play in that in that discussion, in terms of, is it still easier for us to talk about this disease as it relates to third world countries than it is for us to talk about it as it relates to gay Americans, particularly black gay Americans, as you mentioned in the data earlier?
Well, thank you. I think that the leadership of the gay community has been strong throughout the past 25 years and has been responsible for much of the decline in transmission in the United States. I would like to think that we in public health played a role, but I believe that much of the reason for the decline in transmission among gay men in the United States was related to the overwhelming presence of the epidemic and the openness within the gay community to discuss HIV and to accept people who are infected with HIV and to get tested and know about it. The other thing is that AIDS was palpable in the gay community, in virtually every community, in the highly affected cities, on the streets. Virtually everybody knew people who were sick and knew people who were infected and knew people who had died. And that presence of it led to a fairly constant discussion. which led to the young people. Each year in the United States now, you know, a cohort of 4 million people have sex for the first time because that many people are born each year. And as we don't pay a lot of attention to AIDS, both in the media and in our public life, it becomes more difficult for young people to take it as seriously as we did in the 1980s. Now, I think we should not be mistaken to think that homosexual and bisexual men and women are a distinct discriminated against minority throughout the world. The U.S. military policies, for example, remain, you know, institutionally homophobic and are accepted as such. And, of course, gay marriage is something which is accepted in very few places. These two things alone are institutional examples that society does not hold gay and bisexual men and women equal in all ways, and would certainly be a reason for them to show some continued distrust of government.
If I could follow that up with, again, how does that influence the public conversation and the media attention? Again, whenever there's a special or a special report on TV or in the news, it seems as though it's always relegated to discussions on Africa. And how much of a role does sexual orientation play in the domestic debate about HIV and AIDS?
Well, I think that there are I don't want to diminish the extent of the global epidemic. I think it's quite unusual that the United States and the United States media and press and the United States public are focused on the dire consequences associated with poverty in the rest of the world. We're often talking about oil or war or something like that, but when it comes to a health problem, I welcome the global progress that the AIDS virus has made and the difficulty in addressing it. The other thing is, of course, that new things are news, and old stories aren't news. And I think that it's been more difficult in the highly active antiretroviral therapy era to find newsworthy items in AIDS that relate to the domestic situation. Now, having said that, the continuing spread of the epidemic, particularly among young gay men, is not as compelling a story as it would be, as it would be if it were more broadly spread among middle-class people. And I think that continued invisibility and stigmatization of homosexuality is probably a factor.
I'd just like to add to your statement, Jim, which I agree with entirely, that complacency really is an issue that faces us domestically today. And in the face of 40,000 new infections occurring each year, clearly the work is cut out for us in terms of preventing these infections. And I think it's important that the discourse is not only on new infections occurring among men who have sex with men, but indeed other populations which are marginalized in our society. And that's why it's really important that we work with partners such as yourself in the media in getting these messages out and ensuring that these data are made available to as wide an audience as possible, and that the strategies to ensure prevention both at the individual and at the community level are constantly reiterated for the public.
Your next question comes from the line of Daniel Danoon from WebMD. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Dr. Felton, when one looks at the U.S. numbers, one can't help but be appalled by the astonishing progress of the epidemic among African-American men and women. I wonder what we hear often and over again the phrase that prevention messages must be tailored to the community. Can you talk to me, first of all, what specifically CDC and others can do in a specific way to address this astonishing change of numbers? And secondly, I wonder if you could take this question very personally from the position of your own race and own sexuality and talk about how you might affect this issue.
Great. Thanks for your question. Well, I think, first of all, the nature of the evolution of the epidemic means that we need to look at the driving factors in a whole new way. And it's clear that factors such as poverty, drug use, and the high rates of sexually transmitted diseases really place many African Americans at an increased risk of acquiring HIV. However, if we are beginning to think about ways in which we're going to effectively tackle the problem, I would argue that, first of all, there's no simple solution. We need to look at these complex factors, and therefore a comprehensive strategy is going to be required to really curtail HIV among African Americans. And what are the elements of this comprehensive approach? First of all, it will involve involving communities who are at risk very early on in developing interventions, in the implementation of interventions, and even in the evaluation of interventions. In other words, to have participatory approaches to our interventions. We also need to ensure that we work more closely with community leaders to ensure that our interventions are acceptable and appropriate to those who are going to be receiving them as well. Thirdly, I think it's important that we don't view communities as homogenous, that we need to realize that there are differences between men and women, the differences by sexuality, by age group, etc., within each of these communities. And therefore, part of a comprehensive approach will dictate that we use our resources as effectively as possible to meet the needs where they are. Now, to answer your second question, clearly all of us in public health will bring our own personal experiences and our backgrounds to the work that we do. From my perspective, my commitment to fighting this disease began in the early 1990s. And yes, as a man of African descent, it is worrying. It is hurtful to see the evolution of the epidemic, both internationally as well as here in the United States. And that is why I am committed to working very closely with partners across this country, to work very closely with international partners, to ensure that we do tackle this epidemic effectively in new ways that we haven't really taken advantage of in the past.
And your next question comes from the line of Benjamin Ryan from Gay.com, HIV Plus Magazine. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. My question is more of a concern I wanted to address. It follows up on the discussion that you were having from Ryan Lee from Southern Voice. I understand very much when it comes to packaging these press reports that we received, you know, to get the attention of the news media, and I think it's fantastic that you're highlighting the African-American concern and the concern with Latinos, because that's so important. But one sort of soapbox I wanted to get on, coming from the perspective of somebody in the gay media, is this the constancy of the fact that about half of all new infections are among MSM, if you consider the 45% of new diagnoses that are in MSM and another 5% that are in both MSM and IDU. And I guess I'm a little disturbed that there wasn't also a fact sheet highlighting those statistics as well, since they're such an important factor and they continue to be, and hoping that the media would pay attention to that. In particular, the studies that have shown the very high prevalence rates of HIV infection in urban areas that you alluded to with the mention of the high rates of black men. So I was wondering how you would respond to those concerns of mine, that perhaps you haven't packaged the news to try to get the media to continue to pay attention to the gay issue.
Thank you very much for that question. We can provide you with additional and more detailed information on the burden of disease among men who have sex with men. But I think your question is really getting at the heart of how we classify new infections according to risk groups within our population. And yes, unfortunately, we are limited by the fact that oftentimes our data appear dichotomous, either people of color or men who have sex with men. But what we really are trying to convey are very simple messages for a very complex issue, where we have minority men who have sex with men, high rates of disease within these communities, and the need to effectively address those as well. We have certainly published data in previous releases regarding the continuing burden of disease among men who have sex with men in the United States, and specifically the role that men of color, MSM of color, are playing in the ongoing transmission and acquisition of HIV. In fact, we know from a number of studies that we have done that men who have sex with men, there's marked heterogeneity or marked variations across the country in the burden of HIV, either by prevalences in cities or prevalences across risk groups. But the data are fairly consistent that no matter where you look among these larger metropolitan areas, that black men who have sex with men are more than twice as likely to be infected with HIV than other men who have sex with men. So there's a complex intersection between race and sexuality. And in presenting our messages, I think, and I agree with you, that it's important that we do acknowledge this complexity, but at the same time try to present messages which will help both local as well as state-level colleagues to really get the message of prevention out.
Let me add something to that. I would like to just add to the concern that Mr. Ryan had that we don't underestimate the risk to gay men throughout the United States for the foreseeable future. The reason is simple. It's not simply related to how many partners you have. It's related to the likelihood that your partner is infected. And of the million Americans, perhaps half a million or more who are infected are gay men. And gay men, of course, represent only a small percent of the American population. So for the foreseeable future, particularly for young people who are figuring out their sexuality, figuring out their sexual lives, their early sexual partners are much more likely to be infected if they're gay than if they're straight, simply because the prevalence is so much higher. And it's this particular group of people, this group of young people emerging each year, these young gay men, that will, until there's a cure or a vaccine, will always be at much, much higher risk when they have their first sexual contacts than heterosexuals. And we shouldn't lose that emphasis.
That's correct, Jim. And just to add a bit of data on that issue, we know from some of the studies that we've done in large cities across the United States that the prevalences in young men who sex with men, in fact, are staggering. In one study, young men aged 18 to 24, we found the prevalence of HIV of approximately 14%. And by their 30s, these men who sex with men, approximately 30% of them were infected. And even more worryingly, young MSM are least likely to know that they're infected. Indeed, among the 18 to 24-year-old age group, approximately 80% of those who were infected did not know that they were infected. So absolutely correct, and I agree with what you said, that this really is another group that we do need to focus on in our future efforts.
And your next question comes from the line of Joanna Buchan from BBC. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is really based as an outsider looking in and listening to this discussion, which, of course, is based around what's happening in the United States. But when Dr. Curran spoke about hands being tied, we've seen most of my work is done outside the U.S., obviously, and particularly in Africa, India, Russia, China, places like that. And there we've seen PEPFAR is the public face. It's the international face, if you like, of what the U.S. is doing about AIDS. And PEPFAR is tying the hands of people in countries from Uganda to Thailand to Vietnam when it comes to AIDS prevention work because of things like not using condoms, not wanting to go with evidence-based prevention strategies. And that's having an incredible impact on AIDS prevention work around the world. And I haven't heard any mention, really, of, apart from this sort of fairly vague hands-tied reference, to what the U.S. government is doing at home with its policies around prevention work in the U.S. Surely, if the U.S. law at the moment says that you can't talk about abortion, for instance, if you get federal funding, if that applies abroad, it must apply at home in the U.S. So how realistic is it? These plans aren't working in countries like Uganda, Kenya, Thailand. How realistic is it to think that the new policies that are being put in place under these same rules in the U.S. are going to work?
Thanks. Well, first of all, just to say that we're not dealing with any international issues on this conference today, and if we'd like to refer your questions related to the global HIV epidemic and the PEPFAR response to our colleagues in the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, and we'd be happy to give you numbers for that. But in response to the second part of your question, which is the impact, therefore, on policies on policies, I think we are all very cognizant of the fact that we, as public health practitioners, work within a political context. And it's important that as we take the messages and our interventions for prevention forward, that we do look towards comprehensive approaches to prevention. Also remember that a federal approach is not the only approach to prevention in the United States, but in many circumstances, this is added to and supported by local as well as state-level prevention interventions and prevention initiatives, which have oftentimes far more scope to address difficult issues or to make decisions around the nature of prevention interventions in different ways. So do view this as a number of players involved in national HIV prevention in the United States, of which the federal government is a part.
And your final question today comes from the line of Jordan Light from New York Daily News. Please go ahead.
Hi, I have two questions. One would be a follow-up to the previous question. Since we're talking about history, can you maybe provide some context as to how easy or challenging you find your prevention work to be these days under this administration as compared to past administrations? The second question would be, we've been hearing for years that there are an estimated 40,000 new HIV diagnoses or cases, maybe not people who are aware of their status, but an estimated 40,000 new cases annually in the U.S. And I'm just wondering how you come up with that number and why it is that the number never seems to change.
Okay, we'll start with the second part of your question first, and then I'll end with the first part.
Yes, this is Dr. McKenna. The 40,000 number was first directly measured in the early 1990s using a methodology known as back calculation from the number of AIDS cases. And then going forward, when AIDS changed, the epidemiology and progression of AIDS changed because of effective therapy, we had to abandon that method and developed sort of triangulating from a variety of different data to see whether or not there were changes in the trends in transmission. Really, as has been expressed earlier, all the information we have, either measuring number of diagnoses, AIDS cases, doing prevalence studies from blood, indicate a disconcerting stability in those numbers over that period of time, and also all point to really no change since the early 1990s in the number of new infections each year. We will have later this year a much more precise and direct measure of that incidence, as we call it, because of a system we've put in place that has funded 34 areas throughout the United States using a new technology that allows us to discriminate between recent and long-standing infections and be able, as I said, to come up with a real direct measurement of that as opposed to this indirect approach that we've had to use traditionally.
Thanks, Dr. McKenna. And just in response to the first part of your question, which is prevention any more difficult today than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago? I think the considered view of all of this is that prevention is always difficult, but it is truly still the only cure for HIV and AIDS. And the effectiveness of our prevention efforts really depends on the dynamic interplay between a number of factors, the amount of funding we receive, political context. It certainly interrelates to the populations that we serve, and we've mentioned on the call today the importance of complacency, which perhaps makes it even more difficult for some of our target populations to receive our messages. And of course, the epidemic is continually evolving and changing, and therefore we have new populations who are affected by the disease, some of whom are hard to reach, some of whom are not in contact with healthcare services, and therefore new approaches will be necessary. So rather than saying it's more difficult than today, I think we have a different set of challenges which we need to constantly bear in mind and we need to respond to as we take HIV prevention forward. This is the end of a telephone conference. I'd like to thank all of you for calling in today. And once again, just to confirm that if you have further questions, we'd be happy to deal with them through our press office here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Good afternoon, everyone.